Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 402nd edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein, and this is the final show for the 2018 season, as we're going to talk about a couple of topics here and there to discuss what is our plight here with U.S. soccer, what needs to be improved, what could be reduced, and everything else going on. And I'm joined by, once again, my fantastic panelist who has been with me for the start and to the end of every year that I've done this show. Of course, Carter Krishnar from World Soccer Talk and Robert Hay with his own Soccer Minnows website, as we talk about what we feel is a positive or a negative in the world of American soccer. So, gentlemen, before we begin, let me just say this. The reason why we're doing the show on Sunday night is because tomorrow night is Christmas Eve, and I want to do everyone a favor not to broadcast on Christmas Eve. Spend the time with your family. Enjoy the holidays. And even before we even get to this whole thing, gentlemen, Merry Christmas to you and your families.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem at all. No problem at all. Thank you very much. All right, so let's go ahead. One or two topics before the major one I'm going to discuss. But, you know, gentlemen, the first things first. Chris Kessel, who is a member of the West Virginia Soccer State Association, he announced a while ago that he was going to be in the running for vice president of U.S. soccer. Now, at the time, I had no idea that vice president position was not available. And when the, I guess you want to call it a campaign, I guess you want to call voting, however you want to call it, U.S. soccer announced, I believe Christine Rampone Cohn, or is it Cindy Parlo? Who is it again, Kardec, that got the VP nomination and won it?
Cindy Parlo Cohn is the only a candidate that qualified.
Right, that qualified. So in their way, they even said she was the only candidate, in the running for this position. Now, whether or not Chris Kessel was qualified or not, I find it a little bit disingenuous that this man, now granted, West Virginia State Soccer Association, not sure how important that particular state is for the game, but he's doing enough to, you know, get the kids and get players interested into the sport, making sure that everything is doing, you know, well for the state of West Virginia, and we salute him for at least entertaining the idea of, you know, applying his name to the position for, you know, if there was going to be a real vote or not. But the truth is, do you think they didn't want him based because maybe his name is not bright enough, or maybe they just didn't want anyone from the other state associations to run for this vice president position? First with Kardec and then with Robert. Go ahead, Kardec.
Yeah, so Chris, I know quite well and consider him a friend, and I'm disappointed by these developments. Whether Chris was the best candidate for the job or not should have been determined by the general group of stakeholders in U.S. soccer. There were as many as 12 candidates who were interested in running. So Chris isn't the only one here that he's the one who's been most public about not being able to qualify with a second and third endorsement letter. But you had a situation where several candidates wanted to run, and suddenly Cindy Parlo Cohn, former decorated U.S. women's national team player, member of the Athletes Council and employee of board member Steve Malik's club, North Carolina FC, North Carolina Courage, that whole umbrella organization, Steve Malik being a board member of U.S. Soccer, employee of a board member, and then, of course, her husband also works for U.S. Soccer. It seems like there was a lot of, from what I understand, behind the scenes, arm twisting to ensure that Paolo Kohn was put in this position potentially without an election, because they didn't want the kind of messy campaign where talks of conflict of interest and all the same sort of acrimony we had a year ago in the run up to the U.S. Soccer election with the big debate in Philadelphia and the other controversies before we got to the election in Orlando. So this election was going to be in Phoenix in February. There will now not be an election. Cindy Paolo Kohn is the only candidate, and she will get it. It just speaks loudly, once again, about U.S. soccer. There is a group of elites within U.S. soccer that want to continue to control the federation and all that it entails. And I think that that's probably a good place to start tonight, Daniel, in our discussion about where we are at the end of 2018 as we wrap up the year in American soccer.
You know, Robert, and just to get your thoughts as well on this, you know, look, I'm not questioning, you know, Ms. Paolo Kohn's credentials. I'm not doing that. I think, you know, if she is a worthy candidate to become the vice president of U.S. soccer, then so be it. She is a worthy candidate. That's fine by me. I have no qualms about her credentials. But as Carr just pointed out, the qualms are, you know, nepotism is all of a sudden, you know, the hope and prayers of praying to goodness and to God that, you know, nobody else is going to railroad this appointment. And I think, look, if she can do it on her own merits, which I believe she can, I think there's no doubt about it that she can definitely do this on her own, then there shouldn't be an issue at all. They should have just had Mr. Kessel, or whoever else, you know, who wanted to run, you know, go for a campaign. Let's see what's going to happen, and may the best person win.
Yeah, so there's a couple of factors in this that I want to build off what Kardik said. Number one, I think it's very important, and it's good that the U.S. Soccer Federation has more female voices in its leadership, simply because that's where the success for the federation has come. And I think at one level, it's long overdue that there's not more women's soccer voices in the higher ups, the higher echelons of management and leadership, even if it's an elected leadership of the federation. Because again, the U.S. has really been a leader in the world in the past few decades in women's soccer, and so I think it's important that that's finally being recognized. That said, you know, a lot of what I do during the day in the day job is PR and working with media and things like that. And I mean, really, perception is everything in this world, you know, especially in this hyper-connected world. And the U.S. Soccer Federation just simply cannot get out of its way in terms of creating an atmosphere of being on the up and up. I mean, there's a sense, I mean, I think there is truly some paranoia around U.S. soccer where there's this belief that everything is done for the most nefarious reasons. But, you know, they can't help themselves in any of these situations when they do things such as, you know, clear the field in a VP election for someone who has connections, and, you know, they go off and hire as the men's head coach, you know, the brother of a high-ranking official with the club. You know, for whatever reason, and I think Hardik's right, it's this idea of control. There is a small group of people who want control over this process, whether they think they know what's the best thing to do in this to get this federation back on track, or they have the most knowledge and they hold it close and think because they have this knowledge they can run it successfully, or, you know, whatever the reason, there is this group of people that think they know what's best. And they're going to go out and do what's best. And, you know, perception and rules and so on be darned. And what you've created is a sense of, with this federation, at a bare minimum, chaos, and at the most, true nefarious nepotism and an inability to think outside the box. And I think the truth lies somewhere in between the two. But truly, this federation and its leadership does not have a good sense of how to manage, you know, its business in a way that's open and ethical and honest, or at least the perception of it. You know, I think it speaks a lot to the point where there's a lot of people, writers, journalists, and podcasters now who have turned on the Federation that before, you know, would take a stab at defending them and what they did, and have now turned on, and this is a point Kardec's making, so I don't want to not credit him with it. But, you know, there is this now perception throughout U.S. soccer fandom and journalism that this group just can't get its act together. And I think that in this example, you have a situation where you have something good, you know, a new female leader within the Federation, someone who's going to bring a perspective that is much desperately needed, but it's overshadowed by the fact that the perception is they've cleared the field and they've again gone with somebody who has connections to the upper echelon. So, you know, I think, again, you know, looking back on the year and looking ahead, the Federation really needs to work on its outward perceptions and how it does things in order to make sure that what it's doing is open, honest, and ethical, and able to come across as doing what's right for the sport. You know, and actually, you know, well, I'm stuttering a little bit there because I think I'm disagreeing with what I'm just about to say. They need to really work on their PR. Let's put it that way, and I'll stop there.
You want to be hired?
Not for all the tea
well,
in China.
Well, let me say this. You know, it's really hard to believe in whatever process U.S. soccer is trying to tell us, you know, whether it was the coaching candidacy for the U.S. men's national team or even, you know, with the VP position for the Federation. And like we've already said, and I agree, I mean, we need more female voices within the organization. But, you know, it just stinks to high heaven that, you know, while I believe she'll do a great job, Ms. Parlo Cohn, I believe she'll do a great job. I have no doubt that she is very qualified to go and do this job. You know, my hat's off to her. But, you know, Kardec, wouldn't you like to think that, you know, instead of being given the position, you know, she should try and earn it, you know, maybe go on a campaign. Like you said, it was supposed to be sometime in February. Obviously, the next convention is going to be in Chicago this coming January. And you'd like to think that she would talk to her constituents, which would be the American soccer community and all the state association representatives.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think the idea here isn't necessarily, well, she's not potentially the best person for the job or she should have to earn it. I think the issue is that because, as Robert mentioned, this is an organization that's not exactly known for their transparency and openness. But the perception, and perception is reality. I agree with Robert on that. I mean, I do communications and PR as well for a living. So perception is reality, and I tell my clients that all the time. And particularly when you're dealing with legal clients, with lawyers, they have a different perception of things, right? Their own perception as well. The legalisms, they get tripped up in legalisms, and they don't realize the public perception is what defines them. And there are a lot of lawyers around U.S. soccer. That's why I bring that up. I think it would have been an opportunity to have the conversations that we need to have about soccer in this country that we're not having. I think this is an important note, though, what Robert mentioned about the U.S. soccer meeting. And he said, and thank you for giving me credit for that. I've been on that for about 6 months. I think we've seen a definitive turn in some of the most prominent journalists' attitudes. The journalists who were a year or 2 years ago perceived by the pro-rel crowd and the NASL supporting crowd and the people who love the Premier League and hate MLS and that all those subgroups of malcontents within the U.S. soccer community were perceived as being shills for MLS or U.S. soccer. I think the majority of those people who were on that list 2 years ago from those subsets of groups now have sharpened their pens or their pencils and have taken a very critical turn toward the U.S. Federation, a very critical eye now. which puts the Federation in a dangerous position, guys, because, again, perception is reality. I love that Robert brought that up. That's a defining point we need to stick on as we have these conversations. And the perception has been shaped already by the Federation's failures and lack of transparency. It's now being further shaped by reporters who were previously pretty favorable towards the Federation, towards Major League Soccer, and towards the, quote, cause of American soccer, becoming quite critical in their outlook, quite jaded in their approach, and quite cynical about anything the Federation puts out there. So that's why I think this election was critical. It wasn't just to get Chris Kessel or someone like that. Chris Kessel, again, I mentioned, is a personal friend of mine, would have loved to have seen in the position, elected. It's because we're missing the opportunity to have an open book conversation, and the Federation doesn't like doing that, so they have to be forced to do that, and we've now missed that opportunity.
Yeah, and, you know, right there, Robert, you know, that's the one opportunity that we're failing here, and I think U.S. Soccer is failing at right now. Look, I understand, Robert, that, you know, they've already been lambasted on the situation that happened in Trinidad and Tobago back in October of 2017 in that final match in the hexagonal. But, you know, once again, if you would have thought that, you know, maybe U.S. Soccer be a little bit more transparent, then maybe we wouldn't have these discussions. But it looks like they don't care.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you look back on the past year. Depending on how you look at it, this could have been, besides the World Cup debacle or not making the World Cup debacle, you could point to this as potentially being a year where U.S. Soccer is making some major strides. Again, if you look at it in a certain light, you know, securing the 2026 World Cup, looking at some of the good young players that have. Are now playing in Europe and in MLS, and, you know, the good young talent pool that seems to be developing in the U.S. The growth of the domestic game, MLS expanding, you know, the leagues, the professional leagues below it expanding, and a number of other things. Success at the youth national team levels, the women continuing to win. But, you know, the problem with this federation is, you know, it again, to just kind of reinforce this point, what has led to these successes has not been an introspection or a loud discussion of, you know, what we need to do right. It's been more of, you know, let's just keep on doing on, and everything will be okay because we're on the right path. You know, even with an election for the new president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, you know, it's a different name, but seemingly a lot of the same business practices. You know, a new head coach for the men's national team, but, you know, it's from the same cloth as a lot of the previous ones, and there's been no real discussion as to, you know, what the philosophy is and why he was hired over others or something like that. And I know this is slightly off topic, but I think this illustrates the point, Daniel, that you made. One thing that struck me, has always struck me about the hiring process for Greg Berhalter is, when you do a hiring process for a high-profile candidate in sports or in business, you know, whatever, you know, if you want to bring it into politics, you always leak a couple of names, or someone leaks their own name for two reasons. Number one, the person leaks their own name because they want to be seen as being important, or they're trying to renegotiate something. So, you know, a Peter Vermees, for example, would leak his name with the U.S. national team job in case he wanted to, you know, strengthen his position with with Kansas City. The second reason is because the Federation would want to leak a name, or the employer would want to leak a name, so that way they could show that they're doing a due diligence process. There was none of that with this U.S. men's national team position. In fact, it was the exact opposite. It was a search for other candidates. And it's that kind of basics that really drive me nuts about U.S. Soccer Federation. Again, there's so many positives that they could be building up on, but everything is overshadowed by the fact that they go about it the wrong way, or they do things that just fly in the face of logic, of common sense when you're running a business. So, you know, I think that it's just seemingly this impossible. It's either stubbornheadedness or just lack of basic business common sense, which I don't think they have. I think it's just stubbornheadedness to do things in a way that bring people to their side and really build on some of the positive momentum they've had this past year.
Yeah, I agree with you there, Robert. And unfortunately, this is the situation that we are currently in. And until we see Greg Berhalter finally, you know, get this training camp going and getting ready for Panama and Costa Rica over in Glendale, Arizona, and San Jose, California, for these two non-FIFA date friendlies. We'll just have to wait and see what the situation will be, and we're going to have to, you know, move on and wait and see what's going to happen. Hopefully this will be a positive, but if it becomes a negative, we're just going to have to, like, shed the light on it, because if U.S. soccer is not going to understand that this is the wrong way to go into these situations, then U.S. soccer will never learn, and we're going to be back to square one as always. All right, now we're going to go to another topic here. And this topic, gentlemen, is something I'm getting more annoyed at each and every day. And it's not just what's going on in our daily lives or social media daily lives or whatever it is, but I'm, you know, I'm not one of those that mixes politics and sports. I like to keep them both separate because, you know, we have to find a way to take a break from the everyday annoyance. And I apologize. I know Kardec has his Florida Squeeze website going on, and now he's a big political commentator on the internet. And he does. And let me just say,
Daniel, don't apologize. I'm at my wit's end with it, actually, even with my own party, the Democratic Party. So you're singing from the same hymn sheet as me. Continue.
All right. Well, thank you very much. All right. So I shall not praise the Florida Squeeze, but you know, I'm getting sick and tired of, you know, political discussions or, you know, social justice activists of some sort putting their two cents in on sports. And let me tell you what I'm talking about. You know, obviously, you know, Tata Martino, a great manager, not just in club football for Barcelona and other clubs he's probably managed in the past, but also on the national team level for Argentina. Now, there's rumors about him, you know, now that he's no longer with Atlanta United, that apparently he's going to take the job for the Mexican national team for the FMF. And, you know, apparently Mark Fishkin, who does the Seeing Red podcast on the New York Red Bulls, and you know, I've talked with Fishkin a couple of times, and, you know, look, he has his opinions. I respect his opinions. It's okay. Maybe I feel he might be wrong here and there, but the truth is I don't go out of my way to try and, you know, battle over people's opinions. I just want healthy debate and have a good discussion. I'm not looking to intentionally insult people. Yet him and I guess he was not happy that Frank De Boer, who is, I believe, Dutch, has now been hired as new head coach for Atlanta United. And he said, how about an American there, you know, sometime? And, you know, now that got heated a little bit. And then all of a sudden, after a certain argument with, you know, an Atlanta United writer, it's Rob Ushry, and I love Rob. Rob's a good guy, and he's an honest guy, and I enjoy his passion. I enjoy his writing and everything. But then after that, then you get the peanut gallery, and then all of a sudden someone claims Mark is a racist. Now, let me say this. Whoever takes a job as a head coach, either for a club in MLS or for the U.S. men's national team, okay, I do not believe that there is any racial intentions or thoughts from anybody. If Atlanta wanted Frank De Boer, that's fine. More power to them. Have fun. Go ahead. Mark Fishkin has an opinion about these things. Look, I have an opinion about these things. But that doesn't mean that I am looking at the color of the skin of the candidates or of the hire. And yes, he did mention Bruce Arena and Bob Bradley. Now, let me say this. In the international game, probably concede that Bruce Arena is no longer up to specs of the game currently. Tactically, I think he can still do it, but we saw already what happened. You know, he was handed this mess, and then he couldn't finish the job. But I do not believe there are any racial intentions going on anywhere in American soccer whatsoever. And whoever believes that is a fool, is an idiot. And I'm sorry to say it, I do not believe there's anything negative going on. Yes, I wish and actually, you know what? I'll save that opinion a little bit later for this conversation. But, Kartik, you first.
Yeah, I think this is a tough one because I don't like the stereotyping. I don't like the, oh, we must hire this or that. However, I am concerned with the lack of commitment that Major League Soccer, which in my opinion has been a league subsidized indirectly or maybe even actually directly, because Soccer United Marketing is really part of Major League Soccer, directly by the U.S. Soccer Federation, who has coupled its media deal and its marketing deal deals, with the exception of the Nike contract. The Nike contract, U.S. Soccer handles on its own. But the other contracts have been done through some. The media deal is through some. It is coupled and commingled with Major League Soccer. So Major League Soccer has a far more favorable TV deal than they would have earned on their own. And then Major League Soccer in the last few years has gradually increased the percentage of foreign players. So where you have less, you have Americans playing less impactful minutes in their own domestic first division than any other nationality in their own domestic first division in the Western world. And when I talk about the Western world, I'm talking about Australia, Japan, and Western Europe, United States, and Canada. Well, Canada doesn't have a first division right now. But so this is a serious problem. This includes England, by the way. And the Premier League has had the reputation of having too many foreign players. So this is a problem for me because Major League Soccer has been propped up and subsidized, in my opinion, by U.S. Soccer. Now, if Major League Soccer were a truly independent business and they sold their TV rights to ESPN and Fox and Univision directly without coupling it with the U.S. women's and men's national teams, if they used another media partner like an IMG or U.S. Soccer used another media partner like an IMG and not a sub, and MLS was standing on their own 2 feet, I could care less what the player – I think every player could be a foreign player if they meet the immigration standards to get work visas in this country. Then I wouldn't care if there were any American players in the league or any American coaches. Now, I think there should be because the only way you keep it a domestic league and maintain interest, but the market will determine that, right, would be to have a few Americans around. But my contention has been – so, I mean, I'm taking this in a different direction. I apologize. The race thing and the politics, I'm not – concerned about. I'm concerned about the fact that I believe Major League Soccer has an obligation to the U.S. men's game because of the reason why they are standing on they are in the position they are in right now is because they have essentially been subsidized for years. When the U.S. men's national team was successful and Major League Soccer was struggling and money was flowing out of the federation that could have been spent on player development, could have been spent on any number of things. All these problems we're talking about with the federation may have been solved with a little more investment while the U.S. Soccer Federation was making money and the money was going out the door to MLS. So that's where I come down on it. I think Americans do need more chances, both on the playing field and in coaching. It seems the top American coaches now are having to coach in USL. It seems the top American – the MLS Super Draft, I was in a team office last week, and we were joking. The employees and I were joking. I mean, MLS Super Draft is really the USL Super Draft now. It's to see which guys are going to get loaned out. Who are they going to be the top loanee players in the USL next season? So I don't have a problem with that if MLS is an independent business. I mean, the reason why people in England have a problem with it is because the Premier League was essentially a breakaway league that broke off of the Football League with the support and help and aid of the Football Association in England that was in the middle of a dispute with the Football League at the time. So if you're getting assistance from your federation, you better darn well, you know, be looking out for American players and American coaches. This all having been said on that specific hire, Daniel, wow, I'm impressed by Frank DeBoer coming to MLS. Very impressed, and I love it. So I can't agree with Mark Fishkin on that particular hire. I think he might really we could talk about this later, and I'm sure Robert has some thoughts about this stylistically. If the DeBoer-Ajax style were to penetrate Major League Soccer, that would be a big thing for American soccer in general.
I agree. I mean, look, it's fine. I don't mind seeing a guy like him coming over and, you know, saying, you know what I want to do? I want to entrench myself in MLS. I want to show everyone – that while Tata Martino did an excellent job in his only 2 years with Atlanta, watch what I can do, and maybe Greg Berhalter can watch this and, you know, find a way. I mean, look, he has his own style as a head coach. We've seen that with Columbus, and that's great. But wouldn't it be at least, you know, fitting for Berhalter to borrow some of the things that DeBoer might do? I mean, look at Remy Gard. Now, granted, it's Canada, but still, though, that's also a name that, you know, no one expected to come to MLS. And he went to manage in Montreal. Obviously, the French situation, whatever, but still, though, he came to MLS. And that is a name that, you know, many people know, not just from France, but in Europe, who has been probably a good player and has had some successful seasons, you know, in Europe as a club manager. I mean, Robert, I mean, look, how many times were you thinking before, you know, Wayne Rooney came to DC United, how many years you've had to, you know, handle Ben Olsen as a manager? And, you know, you're thinking to yourself, when is it going to be his time to leave? When is it Ben Olsen finally going to get sacked because he's just not doing the job, yet he's still there? And now that he's got, you know, more, you know, talented, quality players on DC United, like a Wayne Rooney, Luciano Acosta is no longer the focal point of DC because now he has help. Yamil Assad is on DC United. You have O'Neill Fisher on DC United. So, you know, what I'm saying is that now that Ben Olsen is looking better, now you don't have to worry about that things. But if just to go back on a little bit, Ben Olsen was sacked. Wouldn't you want a new manager to come in to finally change things up, no matter where he was?
But, yeah. So there's a lot there. Let me see if I can condense this. All right. So let's talk about diversity in management. I think that's kind of where you're going with this, Daniel. And so I'll jump on that. You know, I think this is something we wanted for a long time in MLS, which is diversity of thought and diversity of management styles. I mean, I think for a while the league was done a disservice by we had managers that kind of did basically the same style of play. They came up in the same style of same system. You had American managers that generally had played maybe for the U.S. national team or been around the national team and had a specific style, and that was kind of the stereotype of the league and brought in specific type of players and, you know, had this reputation and so forth. I think when you bring in managers, not only managers like, you know, the ones we have talked about that you just mentioned, Daniel, who have a great international reputation, are known for a very different style from the U.S., but also the fact that, you know, I think what MLS also needs to be doing, and to touch on Cardick's point, which is, you know, we should also be bringing up, MLS also needs at the same time to be having American managers that have a different style, a different thought process, a different way of playing, you know. And I think we're going to get there at one point where we're going to have, hopefully, you know, U.S.-based, U.S. national managers that can play total football or are comfortable with that style or, you know, different styles of play than what normally played in the U.S. camps and the U.S. Coaching academies. But, you know, I think the big thing is not necessarily where the managers are coming from, but also, you know, ultimately it's the style and their perspective. You know, I think that it's good for this league as it grows to have different teams playing different styles with different players and diversifying what the game is in this country. So that way you don't turn on MLS matches and see, you know, the same teams playing the same way. And if you want to see a more dynamic style or more wide open style, you turn on ESPN Plus and watch Eredivisie or La Liga or something like that. But you can see a little bit of La Liga in, you know, MLS. You can see a little bit of the Premier League quote-unquote style, even though there really isn't a style, but maybe the stereotypical style from 10 years ago. But you can see, you know, more German style. You know, I think diversity is the key. That's what you want in MLS, and that's what you want in your managers. You want managers that bring diverse perspectives and diverse styles that can make sure that the game that we're seeing, that the teams are constantly challenging each other, and that what we're seeing on the pitch is exciting and interesting because it is a tactical game and not just a physical game. And so I think the more the MLS can attract people from overseas, managers with big profiles, but also develop these managers internally, is important. You know, I think that, you know, the success of Jesse Marsh ultimately either in Europe or in the United States, might be the biggest success for U.S. coaching in the next 10 years. If he can be a successful coach and come back to the U.S. and really change either as a club or country, you know, how we play soccer, I think that could be something to watch.
No, I agree with you there about Jesse Marsh. I mean, you know, I've seen it firsthand what he has done for the New York Red Bulls. And, of course, you know, look, trying to adapt the situation that goes on, you know, Ralf Rangnick, who is right now manager at Red Bull Leipzig in the Bundesliga, which Jesse Marsh is at the moment one of his assistants right now. To see him doing something over there, hopefully, we will have to wait and see what the situation will be for him in the future. But still, though, and I'm going to once again throw this out again, and Karthik and I have mentioned this many, many times. If I'm repeating myself, I apologize. But, you know, look, I would have loved to have seen either Tata Martino or Juan Carlos Osorio or Todd Ramos get an opportunity to be the manager of the U.S. men's national team. And once again, as we've said, this is not about being racist against them. I just think U.S. soccer was stupid. And sadly, stupidity is still a legitimate gripe in the world today, of whether it's the wrong game plan or it's just you did something you shouldn't have done. Why didn't you ask these questions? Why didn't you ask those questions? And Karthik, once again, you know, if they did that to, you know, these two men, one, and like I've said, you know, Tata Martino, Karthik, is a world-class manager, without a doubt. I mean, to have Lionel Messi as a manager, you know, on the club level with Barcelona, and then on the world stage as manager of Argentina, I mean, he had the best of both worlds with one particular guy. You can't disagree with his pedigree. And I'm not trying to disagree about his pedigree. I think Tata Martino would have been a fantastic manager for the U.S. men's national team. But stupidity, not racism, stupidity put themselves in a position for U.S. soccer that should never have happened in the first place. They should have had a worldwide coaching candidacy, you know, hunt down to get someone like him. Or even Juan Carlos Osorio, who wanted the job, and still they didn't even bother to contact him. This is all I'm saying. This is not about the color of the skin. This is about a move that, and I'm not saying I didn't want Greg Berhalter, but what I'm saying is they did not allow themselves to create a process to bring these people for a conversation. That's all you're asking.
Yeah, obviously we've talked about this over and over again. You mentioned Ralf Rangnick. I don't know if a lot of our listeners know, he was a finalist for the England job when Sam Allardyce was hired 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. So England went outside their comfort zone and they looked at someone very seriously. Granted, Rangnick was the only non-British Isles candidate for the job, or finalist for the job, but they looked at someone from outside the circle, someone who had never managed in England before, someone whose entire management career had come in German and Austrian football and Swiss football, but thought, you know, he had the stylistic principles that they wanted, and those stylistic principles are now actually being implemented by Gareth Southgate very successfully. But I think that there was a very narrow focus in this. Juan Carlos Osorio was a guy that I think very logically we thought would be on the short list, and was on most people's short lists, but U.S. soccer never had a process in place when he had to make a decision. And he had to make a decision about Paraguay after, you know, some people would say after he had behaved inappropriately towards Jose Pekerman and potentially trying to undermine him to get the Colombia job. But whatever the case, his timeline didn't match up with the U.S.'s timeline. And then you mentioned Tata Martino. I think we could be excited by what he did with Atlanta. Whether he was the right fit or not, I don't know. But it would have been good for Dan Flynn and Jay Berhalter and Carlos Cordero to talk to him. And I think you mentioned someone else. Oh, yeah, Tab Ramos. Yeah, that's another one that I think a lot of people are unhappy about. My understanding with Ramos is, though, that he has not interviewed well in the past when he's been up for MLS jobs or for other jobs. So perhaps based on that information, they chose not to to interview him. I'm again more perplexed about Jesse Marsh and Peter Vermees not getting interviews. And Robert mentioned the strategic leak thing, which is something in the comms business we're very familiar with. I don't want to say I do it all the time, but I do. You know, it's part of the business, right? And the lack of strategic leaks on the U.S. Soccer Federation search and interviews and person X being a candidate, Robert nailed it. That was very glaring. So I think people who are in the business professionally. Now, on the Peter Vermees issue, specifically, U.S. Soccer tried to circle back after it had leaked that Vermees had not been a candidate for the job. They tried to circle back and say, well, actually, you know, he was, but we didn't interview him, but whatever the case is. I think when it comes down to it, they realized after the fact what Robert said about strategic leaks, that they should have gone ahead and leaked maybe at the beginning of the process. Oh, we like Jesse. We have a short list of 10 guys. Jesse and somehow Jesse Marsh and Peter Vermees would have ended up on that list, because that would have quelled a lot of the anger they feel now. If it looked like Greg Berhalter was legit, there would still be some charges of nepotism, and there would be probably a bad perception out there. But they would have mitigated some of the backlash if they had released saying, hey, there are like 8 to 10 candidates. It includes domestic coaches like Greg Berhalter, Jesse Marsh, and Peter Vermees. But they never did that. And maybe they could have thrown like a foreign coach in there. Oh, we want to see if, I don't know, Fabio Capello will come. Want to see if Manuel Pellegrini will come. Something like that, right? No, but I'm serious. Because here's something that I think, back to Robert's point, because I think that's such an important point. I'm sorry we're taking a lot of time on it. May not have been where you wanted to go, Daniel, but Robert brought it up, and I think it's worthy of discussion. When Sunil Gulati was the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, if he had a meeting with a Marcelo Lippi or a Fabio Capello or a Jose Pekerman-type figure in international football, it would inevitably be leaked through some American journalists that Gulati is so connected in the game, he's talking to Fabio Capello about getting some technical suggestions. You know, he and Bob Bradley are meeting with Fabio Capello, that sort of thing. So the U.S. Soccer Federation in the past has done this, or maybe Sunil himself has done it. The fact that they didn't have any of those strategic leaks this time means they probably didn't talk to anyone. And it's very, very damning on this whole process. I mean, the whole diversity in hiring, diversity in U.S. soccer thing is an important topic. But I also think, just circling back, optically, the perception of U.S. soccer is very important in terms of how they conduct their searches for coaches and for other employees. And now we're going to have the Secretary General job open, Dan Flynn's, the CEO job open, Dan Flynn's job. How is that search going to go? How is that process going to be to hire the most powerful man in the game in this country? That we still don't know. We still don't know the timeline on it. We still don't know the parameters. We still don't know who's doing the hiring, any of that stuff. So that's going to come up this year in 2019, unless Flynn rescinds his retirement. So, again, they're just these things pile on in time.
And once again, I'll send Robert Hay in a special package to Soccer House in Chicago. When Dan Flynn's already out the door, he'll automatically be put in, and we'll try and trip up the computers to make sure that Robert's name gets on there as soon as possible. But no.
I'm very happy with my current day job. I just want to put that out, since this is being recorded for the public record. I love my current day job.
That's very true. But Robert, I want to throw this out at you. Now that if you remember the interview that Jose Mourinho once had on ESPN FC, I think it was, long time ago, that he could see himself one day managing the U.S. men's national team. Well, sadly, that's been maybe 10 matches too late, since he just recently got sacked by Manchester United. I would have said, yeah, Jose Mourinho for U.S. men's national team. Let's make it happen. He said it. Go ESPN. Go get the documents. Go get the archive video. But, you know, that would have been interesting if he, you know, if he wanted to take that job, which I think he'd take Portugal first before he would take the U.S. men's national team job. But still, though, Robert, from what you have read and what you have seen, does it infuriate you sometimes to see this stupidity on social media? Because as soon as someone, you know, wants to have a discussion or a debate of certain people, of situations, you know, in the sports world and everything, does it infuriate you that the first thing that has to be typed or said or recorded is you're a racist? I mean, doesn't this infuriate you because that is not the real reason that this situation happened?
Yeah, thanks for coming around back to that point, because I had a little note written to myself about this. You know, I think the tough thing, you know, social media has always been talked about as this force of good, this idea of bringing people together and connecting people. And I think, you know, this phone call is an example. The show is an example of that. I mean, we all, the three of us, have come together because of social media and reaching out and collaborating on different ideas, not face-to-face, but over the Internet. And so I think that shows the power of social media and the current Internet age. The problem is that it's so easy to depersonalize communications with people. So it's easy to sit there and pull up, you know, I have TweetDeck here in front of me, looking at the stream of tweets going through. And it's very easy to sit there and get mad at a tweet that pops up on my screen and just, you know, hit, you know, reply, whatever, and type the first thing that comes to my mind. Because what I'm just staring at words at my screen. I'm not staring at the person face-to-face that's typing this. And I'm not, you know, when you have a face-to-face or a voice-to-voice conversation, it's a lot harder to sit there and accuse people of things because you can hear or see in their face where they're coming from, you know, why they're talking about the way they are. But in 100 or 280 characters, it's very easy to confuse or assume or not understand the point of what's being said. And it's very easy to reply, you know, if it's on Twitter, it's 280 characters, Facebook, whatever the medium is, it's very easy to just type out a reply to something without understanding the person behind it. And I think that's the downside to the current media. And it's so easy to make a name for yourself or to get attention by being negative on everything. And, you know, I'm not saying this about the people who do feel passionately about things and are trying to make a difference in the world and who may go out on social media and try and help people with certain issues. But I am talking about the people that sit there and just react without thinking and sit there and read something and react. And I think that really, and we've seen that trickle down into every aspect of life, whether it's pop culture, politics, sports, everything. This has affected everything that we do. And so, you know, when we talk about these other issues, we talk about the hiring of a U.S. men's national team coach, or we talk about, you know, the new presidential election or decisions made by the league or marketing decisions or things like that. It's easy for people to sit there and say, well, so-and-so is done, this happened because of this. And, you know, you're saying this because of that, because you believe this, or you're this kind of person, or that is something that someone like you would say. And the consequences are really, you know, less than if this was an in-person conversation at a restaurant or a bar or something, or, you know, a convention or something like that. And so it's too easy these days to just really react, quickly react. And I won't bring politics into this, but I think there's a couple of fairly good examples in the political realm of what happens when you just react without talking to people face-to-face and just react on social media. And this is, I think, poisoning the conversation that we're having on a lot of issues that are semi-important and somewhat important or just interesting and entertaining. So I think it's best that, you know, everybody involved in social media just kind of sits back and before you type a reply or post a comment or something like that, just think about it and say, you know what, is what I'm saying something I'd say to somebody to their face? And if it is, go ahead. And if it's not, you know, maybe you shouldn't be typing it, and maybe that would cut down on all the stupidity and the poison that's being put out there on the Internet.
Exactly. And that's why I'm speaking out on this, because what we have seen so far you know, in daily life, and not just in daily life. Now it's crept into our soccer conversations, into our football conversations. We're seeing people either baiting others to try to get their agenda discussed, or pointing the fingers and saying, you know what, this is why I don't want to be in this country anymore. This is why I don't want to be here anymore, because of what is going on here. You know, it's gotten to the point, gentlemen, where it's gone overboard. It's gone way too far. And I think what we need to make sure is this, is that, you know, if you have something critical to discuss, if you have something that's going to bring a certain topic, you know, shed some light into it, that's fine. But let's have it, you know, more common sense. And I think that's what we're missing here, guys. This is what we're missing. We're missing common sense discussion. And if we have common sense discussion, then we don't have to, you know, have our, you know, we don't have to bang our heads on our tables, on our chairs, and to the walls, because the less of this nonsense ends, the more I think everyone can have, you know, their head screwed on right, and as I've said, you know, have a good head on your shoulders. And I think that's what we're missing here. Okay, now that's over with, because I don't want to talk about this topic anymore. We've talked about it enough. I've talked about it enough. Even I get upset at myself if I get involved in these types of discussions. But, gentlemen, this is the main crux of tonight's show. And first things first, we have to say this. I am happy that we are seeing more leagues coming around for our game. I'm happy to see that not only that the USL has their Division III league and USL I, I'm happy to see the NPSL, which is the National Premier Soccer League, they are having their professional league, their professional division coming to fruition. Obviously, the NISA, the National Independent Soccer Association, they're coming to fruition hopefully very soon. If not, you know, this season, maybe next year, and we know it's going to be modeled along the international calendar for what FIFA has done. Any new professional leagues that come in, I welcome it. I welcome it because we need more leagues in this country. We need to give more opportunities to players. And I'm not trying to poo-poo the lower levels, or shall we say the amateur leagues. They are more than needed as well, too. But you want to grow the game, and the professional leagues and the professional level should be there for everyone as well, and I'm happy this is happening. But now, gentlemen, the question that I am about to ask you is this. Because we all know that in England, there are more than just three or four levels of professional leagues within that country. Obviously, England has, you can count maybe 9, 12, 20. There's so many clubs in England that are mostly professional. Not enough amateur levels. Maybe some youth clubs here and there on their own, but mostly youth clubs are coming from the professional clubs as well because they have their own academies. But our country is just as big as well within this area of the world in our region. Gentlemen, there's only three professional divisions in the United States. And I understand NPSL, and I'm not poo-pooing them. I'm not trying to say they shouldn't be there. I'm glad that they're here getting ready for the middle of 2019. But the truth of the matter is this, and this time we're going to start with Robert and then Kardik. Robert, do you think it's time that U.S. soccer now expands the professional leagues divisions into a fourth division, a fifth division, and maybe a sixth division if necessary?
Oh, absolutely. I've long been on record as saying that I think that a country of our size and population and diverse interests would benefit from having a large number of professional, semi-professional, and amateur teams in a good structure. I mean, listen, we live in a globalized world, and you know, some could argue that if you live in suburban area, town in Texas, why would you need your own semi-pro team when you can watch Manchester United or whatever? Well, I think that having a local team really helps grow the game because it gives you an opportunity to, you know, bring family members, your kids or whatever out to see a local team that you can support, players that you might see, you know, on the street or even, you know, or from your community, depending on what level you're on. It grows an identity, you know, through success. If your team is successful, it gives, you know, the community something to rally around. I think it's very important to have as many leagues and teams as possible that can be supported. And, you know, I do think that this country, we certainly do have the wealth and the resources to support, you know, regional leagues, a few national leagues, mostly regional leagues, you know, up and down the professional ladder. You know, and I think that it is something that probably should have been a little bit more developed by now. But, you know, when you look at England and the history of soccer there, I mean, it took time to really shake out into the structure that it is now. And they're, you know, obviously a much smaller country size and population-wise. And even now it's still developing. The Premier League is a relatively young entity. If you look at, I guess, the history of the sport, it's, I guess, relatively young. You could still say that. But, you know, so these type of things take time. And especially in a country like this where soccer is a late-arriving sport, you know, it's going to take time to develop a structure. But we are behind, I think, in where we should be. I think U.S. soccer should have made this a priority earlier on instead of focusing on kind of the big high-ticket things, which, you know, like winning a World Cup in 2010 or, you know, just focusing on MLS instead of at lower levels. But, you know, I think a good focus on growing the game throughout the country in different ways and giving every area an opportunity to develop its own soccer culture is critical. And if U.S. soccer today said that is a top priority for us so that by the time the World Cup comes to the U.S. in 2026, we are a vibrant soccer culture, I don't think that's an unrealistic goal, and I think that it is certainly something worth supporting.
Kardik, I think we've talked about this off the air. You know, look, I'm not against the NPSL creating a professional division. I'm not against the NISA creating their own league. But the one thing I am more concerned about, and once again, this also falls on U.S. soccer, is that, you know, in their bylaws, that you can probably have two first division leagues. And once again, I consider that to be a detriment to our country. Not that I'm saying I don't want to have more professional leagues, but, you know, what U.S. soccer had said a long time ago when MLS came to fruition, MLS is the Division I league. MLS is our top league. It is the top league in our country. Yes, the NASL came, and unfortunately it's gone. But still, you have USL as second division. Their USL now as champion, the championship league, is now second division. USL League One is third division. But then, and I still disagree with the premises that USL League Two is the amateur league, which I disagree. I think PDL should have remained, and USL League Two should have been an actual professional division. And to see MPSL Pro, and like I said, I'm not against them. I'm happy they're here. But they're going to be a third division league, and they're going to be on the same level as USL League One. And that's where I have the problem. I think that we should have a Division Four. And, you know, whether it's USL League One or MPSL Pro, someone should take over as Division Four. Like I said, I don't think we should go to England where they have nine professional leagues, because I think that's a little too much for where we are currently. Maybe down the road somewhere, probably in the future. But right now, we're seeing clubs like Detroit City FC, Chattanooga FC, and we're also seeing, you know, these clubs that have a strong following, a great following, now joining as a professional league for NPSL's professional division. I think that should be considered Division Four. Your thoughts, Cardiff?
Well, we have hundreds of amateur teams that are playing at what are essentially the fourth division level in this country. So there's very little to distinguish a lot of the NPSL teams from Now what is USL League 2, formerly the PDL, and then also UPSL. And then there's also a number of local leagues, the Great Lakes League, the Gulf Coast League, a local, more localized league, the APSL, which we have here in Florida, the Pacific Coast League. There are a number of these smaller regional leagues that are producing players and clubs and community stories, you know, like AFC Mobile and teams like that. Minneapolis City FC is now in NPSL, but they started out, Grand Rapids started out in one of the best, Grand Rapids and Ann Arbor, two of the best NPSL clubs, started out in the Great Lakes League. So there are all these other leagues where U.S. soccer has not taken an interest, okay? And I think Robert's point is absolutely right. What we found, actually, is that because of the suburban makeup of a lot of youth soccer communities and fans of European football in this country, putting a local semi-professional club close to them, whether it be in – and we tried this in the NASL, right? Our original idea was to put a team in Prince William or Loudoun County, Virginia, on the outskirts of the Washington, D.C. area. We didn't pull it off. USL is now trying it. NISA might try it. NISA might try to put a team in Prince William County. I know USL has announced a team, or we'll have a team starting next year in Loudoun. This is becoming a more and more of a concept that is being thought of as potentially something that can work to bind suburban communities. DeKalb County is going to have a team in NISA, DeKalb County, Georgia. There is a potential for a NISA team on the outskirts of Orlando, from what I understand, you know, not in the city like Orlando City is, right in Paramore, but on the outskirts of town. And NISA is looking at the South Florida market also. And South Florida obviously has any number of teams at this level, including two Miami teams in the NPSL Founders Cup. You mentioned the NPSL Pro, NPSL Founders Cup. I'm not quite sure if that's, you would classify that as a third division league or a second division league. They have a very different kind of concept. They don't want to abide by the pro league standards, but they're going to have clubs in geographic clusters. So this is interesting. I think as we move this discussion forward, USL League One, which is the third division, and NISA have decided to just kind of throw teams where they can throw teams. So thus far, USL League One is going to have a team in Arizona, a team in Orlando, a team in Toronto, a team in Madison, Wisconsin, a team in Lansing. Madison and Lansing are kind of close to each other. But teams all over the place, right? There's a North Texas team in the Dallas area. So this is a sprawling league without many geographic clusters. NISA, they're going to have a San Diego team, which they haven't announced yet. I just mentioned Prince William County, Virginia. They've announced that Atlanta team. They've announced a team in the Philly area. They've announced a team in Connecticut. So, again, kind of a sprawling league. The NPSL Pro you mentioned, Daniel, is going to be – they've already split the league in half in terms of regional play. There are four teams in Southern California. They have 11 teams total. They have four teams in Southern California, two teams in Miami, a potential third team actually in South Florida that pulled out. So they were looking to have three in South Florida, four in Southern California. That was going to be the majority of the teams they had in the league. And then, you know, a team in Oakland, a team in Tucson to round out the West, a team in New York, the Cosmos, obviously, and then teams in Detroit and Milwaukee, in Chattanooga, to round out the East. The idea behind that league is to kind of mitigate travel costs by having regional play and keeping teams in small clusters. Like I said, they wanted a third team in South Florida. They had that team. It looked like that team has opted just to continue in the regular NPSL. So it's interesting because as we go forward with these professional leagues and the idea of having more professional leagues and more professional teams, do you want national leagues or do you want regional leagues or leagues that regionalize the play? And I think that's going to be the next thing we have to discuss as these pro leagues form, because too many teams have gone out of business at the lower division level. And I think, as I just said, in Southern California, NPSL Founders Cup will have four teams. So there's this thought process that you can have a team in a city and then have a team that's its rival in the suburbs of the same city and create a derby atmosphere. And I know talking to Ricardo Silva and the people here in South Florida with Miami FC, that's what they very much wanted. They had the derby with Fort Lauderdale in the NASL. They wanted another derby with Fort Lauderdale team in this NPSL thing. That didn't come off, but they've got another team in Miami. They're very much about creating those local rivalries. I'm not sure USL and NISA are quite into that. So that's something as you go forward. When you talk about capturing the fans in suburban communities, getting them into local football, getting the players who are in those youth systems playing at a local club, easier for them to play at a local club. Again, you know, using the example of South Florida, it's much easier to get them to play at a local club in Weston or Pembroke Pines if they're there than actually, you know, them having to go somewhere else to play. It's the same thing in the D.C. area where Roberts hails from, although I have to see the soccer community in the Washington, D.C. area is so fragmented that people who are investors want to stay out of the area because the youth soccer community is so split there. But hypothetically, if you have a guy playing if you have a kid that's flying his trade in the Maryland suburbs who's in Gaithersburg or is in Rockville, you would want to keep them at a club near there. They don't necessarily have to play in DC United in Audi Field, right?
Right.
If they come up the ranks, it'd be great if they had a team in Silver Spring or some place near their youth club. So I think as we evolve in this getting more professional clubs, we're going to get to that point that we have. I know the romanticism is, oh, we can put teams in every little small town. I think it's more about putting teams in the suburbs of major metropolitan areas, which produce a lot of players. If you look at the clusters that produce a lot of players in this country, it is Southern California, it is Northern New Jersey, it is the Washington, D.C. area, it is the Miami area, or South Florida area, the Dallas area, and the Atlanta area. And Chicagoland used to be there. It's kind of faded. It's only a couple of clusters. And now Seattle and Portland, Seattle especially, is emerging as one. You want to get as many teams in those areas as possible as we grow. If we're talking about growing the American player now, if we're talking about growing the sport for commercial reasons, there are advantages to that also, but there are also advantages to putting teams in Abilene, Texas, and places like that. But I think it's a very interesting concept, and I'm glad Robert brought up the suburban clubs because I was actually going to bring that up as well because I think that's a big part of the next steps.
Well, let me say this, Robert. You know, if you're from Baltimore, they want nothing to do with Washington, D.C. because
same
you
on
know
our
as
end.
Well as I do. Yeah, exactly. That's why they cheered for Christos in the Open Cup and not for D.C. over in Boyd's, which I still watch that goal by Conce of Christos. I mean, just to watch that free kick get buried and seeing basically your block of DC fans on the opposite side of the field at the midfield stripe and everyone else wearing, you know, neon green shirts going ballistic. And that's just like, that was awesome. But still though, you know, that's what I've learned a long time ago. If you're from Baltimore, they don't want to be told that they're DC fans or at least from Washington, DC, like, the, you know, for baseball or football or anything.
Yes. No. I'm not going to use the semi-offensive name that we call people from Baltimore. So we'll just leave it at that.
Remain professional.
No. We won't throw out Baltimore ons or anything like that. You know, I do, and I say that as someone who has a number of good friends in Baltimore, the Baltimore area. You know, I want to touch on one of Cardick's points, and that's about the D.C. area. And I think D.C., in a sense, is a good example of what has gone wrong and what can go wrong with U.S. soccer and the fragmentation of, you know, the sports, the youth sports scene in D.C. I mean, as he mentioned, and I'll speak to this since I am a native who lives here, you know, as he mentioned, it's a very good area for soccer. Not only at the college level is there a lot of success with University of Maryland and there what they've seen, you know, winning a national championship and so forth, but also at the high school level and then, you know, professionally DC United doing what it did early on in MLS. But it is a vibrant youth soccer area. You know, both in Maryland and Virginia, there's a number of clubs that
have national reputations and have developed, you know, players that we know of and we recognize the names of, but it is very fragmented in the sense of, you know, the pathway. I have a kid who's at the very, very early, low levels of the soccer pyramid, the you know, soccer development pyramid in this area. And looking at a chart of where clubs go and what the top leagues are and everything like that is an absolute mess. And the club has even said that to us when we go to meetings. They say, you know, don't even worry about, you know, figuring out which is the best leagues and what progress is up leagues. And if your team is in this league versus this league, it's better than this league. And like, it doesn't work like that. I mean, if you have a player who is talented and who might be a special player who could develop into something one day, there is no path to go where you go from A to B to C to D, T and F. You can go from A to Z or B to E and then back to H, and then it's just a big mess. And if you are the parent of a kid who's talented in soccer, a lot of them are just going to the bright lights and going to a club with Real or DC United Academy on the name, or, you know, affiliated with a European team. I mean, there's clubs that have European club names attached to them that I'm not still quite sure what they have to do with that club, except that maybe signed a deal where they could use their logo. But, you know, from a parent perspective, you really don't know what to do with a kid to maximize their soccer development. There's just so many options and so much competition for players and for attention and for the money that it gives you a brain bleed if you're serious about it. And that's, I think, leads to this idea of, you know, stereotypical parents and competitive matches at age 13 where, you know, parents and referees are getting fights and so on and so forth. You know, in a country this large, it's not going to be easy to come up with a system where it's one size fits all, where if you're a talented player, you go through this process to figure out if you are a future college player or national team player or something like that. But it is a just an absolute mess in terms of competing for talent in an area like D.C. and in these other areas that Cardiff mentioned, I'm sure, but I can speak specifically to D.C. And talking to people who have kids that are that talented. It's tough. I mean, it really is tough, and it is a depressing scene in the sense that, you know, there's very little guidance, and there's a lot of kids thrown by the wayside because they chose the wrong path, or they chose a path that had more seemingly promise and had the fancier names but ended up with bad coaches and administrators that discarded them at the first sign of lack of progress. And it's just and I think this is where U.S. soccer, you know, going back to the earlier point, can really step in and provide some guidance rather than just sitting there and saying, well, you know, if you're born in this year, this is the age group you have to play in, and by the way, you've got 2 years to implement it, have fun, good luck, goodbye. You know, if they really invested in coaching and structure and funding, you know, and again, we're a big country, but really trying to give some guidance to these leagues, these soccer associations, and the parents and the players, they really focus on that. I think that could do a lot of good, not only in the short term for making sure that youth soccer is better, but also develop better players in the long term and players that are more well-rounded and ready to represent the national team one day.
And, you know, Cardiff, let me throw this out at you, because I've talked to maybe a couple of people, and we all know, you know, promotion relegation should only be involved, or if we're going to expand professional divisions in America, then promotion relegation should be on the forefront on this type of a topic. I mean, for now, and I'm not saying, like we've always said, I'm not against that. I think, you know, sooner rather than later, hopefully, I think when everyone who's involved in any level, either professional or amateur, in U.S. soccer, that we should have promotion relegation involved. But I don't think that should be a deterrent to not expand professional divisions within our country. I think for now, I think it's a positive to expand the professional divisions. But at the same time, you know, until everyone's on the same page, you know, we don't have to rush this. Shouldn't be rushed. I just think right now, we need to expand our professional divisions by maybe a Division 4, even a Division 5 if it's possible. But still, though, I just find it right now, Cardiff, that, you know, There are so many professional teams coming in. And then what are we going to do when, because, you know, MLS, well, we'll get to that in a minute, but, you know, just to expand the professional divisions, I think it's a number one concern to increase the health of the game.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue, I think the most important thing now would be to figure out training compensation and solidarity payments. I think, and that's gone to the CAS. We know what's going on there in terms of the Crossfire case out of Seattle with DeAndre Yedlin and his transfer to Spurs, right? So that's running its mm-hmm. course. Jeff Carlisle had some good reporting on that last week. I'm in touch, I should say, here on the show, I'm in fairly frequent touch with people around that case, including the attorneys for Crossfire. So I think that's right now the number one thing that can change, because you saw MLS has now opened the door to accepting some sort of solidarity payment scheme with how they handled the Alphonso Davies transfer from Vancouver to Bayern, and how they compensated his youth club, his development club in Edmonton. So I think that's the first step. Then I would agree the professional divisions need to be expanded. We need to get to a sweet spot. I think promotion and relegation is great, but we have to figure out how we implement it, where the potential pitfalls are, and we have to unify the pyramid. Right now, there's too much fragmentation. There's too many conflicting corporate structures. For example, let's just look at the first and second divisions. The first division is a single entity league, Major League Soccer. This is obviously on the men's side. Well, on the women's side too. NWSL is a single entity league. And then the second division is USL, which is a franchise-based league, like the other American professional sports leagues. So just even having a pyramid with first one and two, single entity, franchise-based, it's completely different. MLS doesn't sell franchises. They sell ownership shares in a single entity. USL doesn't sell ownership shares in a single entity. They sell franchises, and the league itself is owned by a third party. So those business models are, at least on the surface, irreconcilable. They're completely different, the way those two leagues are run and operated. So U.S. soccer would have to step in and solve that. And then, you know, you open yourself up to litigation. We have laws in terms of shareholder rights and all sorts of franchisee rights and even maybe some antitrust issues come into play there. U.S. soccer is facing a number of lawsuits right now, an antitrust lawsuit, a fiduciary duty lawsuit, a lawsuit by the U.S. Soccer Foundation that was filed in Washington, in D.C., 2 weeks ago. They're facing that CAS filing I mentioned from Crossfire Premier out of Seattle. They're facing a case in the Court of Arbitration on Sports filed by Miami FC, which is probably going to get heard this year, I understand, regarding the structure of the professional leagues. So they've got a lot of litigation pending, and that stuff would have to be dealt with before we put together kind of a unified professional structure.
Absolutely, and I think that's going to be, you know, if not a talking point, it's going to be one of many talking points, because right now U.S. soccer, they're just not in a good position at the moment. And whether, you know, they want to admit it or not, we'll see what happens. Let's make one more topic here. And this one is interesting. As many of you know, the Canadian Soccer Association, along with other businessmen in Canada, have created for the start of next year the Canadian Premier League. Our colleague Dwayne Rollins from the Sports Podcasting Network has been a part of this situation, reporting what's been going on. And once again, I've always been for the country of Canada to have their own Division One league, and I'm very happy. And of course, maybe somewhere down the line, maybe Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver will be grandfathered in after the Canadian Premier League establishes themselves. But there's one club at the moment that is Canadian that has remained in the USL, and that is the Ottawa Fury. And it's kind of funny. President of CONCACAF is Victor Montagliani, who is the former president of the Canadian Soccer Association. Apparently, it sounds like everyone was fine with this, even though probably there's some grumblings from within Canada that Ottawa is not joining the Canadian Premier League this year, or shall we say next year in 2019. But still, Victor Montagliani is in some ways, if you want to say emergency powers, trying to force Ottawa to leave USL Championship and go into the Canadian Premier League. We have never seen a president of CONCACAF. Then again, it's only been Jack Warner that I can remember. Forcing a club that is a part of a U.S. league, and we know there are some clubs in Wales that are part of the Premier League, forcing a Canadian team to now join a fledgling Canadian Division One league, first with Cardick, and then we go to Robert. Your thoughts, Cardick?
Well, it's not quite like that. I mean, there are FIFA statutes that govern that say only under exceptional circumstances can a team. Now, by the way, CONCACAF has backed off this for 2019. Well, this will be revisited, I think, before 2020. But if there are exceptional circumstances, which say a club does not have a first division to play in, or the first division in their country is so beneath the standard in terms of payroll, in terms of all of that stuff, of the league they're in as a guest team in a foreign country. The Canadian Premier League is probably going to have more national sponsorships and a better TV deal in Canada than USL has in the United States. Okay, USL has preferred partners. They have vendors they work with. They do not have any out-and-out blue ticket, high-end league sponsors that then distribute revenues to their member clubs. And again, they're a franchise-based league, so it works a little differently than it does at the single-entity level with MLS. A franchise-based league owned by a third party. I sympathize with Ottawa, and I think that this is the right decision to let them play in 2019 in USL. The schedules are done, and they're printed, and tickets have gone on sale. But let me backtrack here. I think there's been a lot of mischaracterization of the situation. I've been in touch with CONCACAF. I'm based in South Florida. CONCACAF is based in Miami. They moved from New York to Miami a few years ago after Jack Warner was relieved of his duties and Chuck Blazer resigned. They moved the operation to South Florida. And so I was able to have some communication with folks over there. And the reality is USL and Ottawa did not follow the normal procedure for asking for a waiver. They just went ahead and made assumptions about things. And then when there were some objections raised, created a public stink. So the Wales situation is not analogous. Cardiff, Wrexham, Newport, Swansea, the four Welsh teams in the English football pyramid, they were there before Wales had their own leagues, much like Ottawa and et cetera. However, this is important to note. They must qualify for European competition via the English pyramid. So if Ottawa wants to stay in USL indefinitely, they should not be permitted under that precedent there to play in the Canadian Championship. They should have to enter the U.S. Open Cup in order to qualify for the CONCACAF Champions League. Now, I don't think they want that. So you can't have it both ways. The other thing I would point out on this is that I think USL has made noises about expanding into other countries. They've had teams in Antigua previously. They've had a team in Bermuda previously, professional third division teams in those two countries. They're making noises again about expanding into other places. So CONCACAF wanted to put their foot down now and say, look, I mean, you can't just willy-nilly expand. You're a U.S.-based league. There's a process for this. I think if they were to go into, let's say, the Cayman Islands or something, there's not a viable first division in those sorts of places. But there's still a process for doing this. And CONCACAF, as the trustee of FIFA, as the governing body for FIFA in this part of the world, has an obligation to not just let professional leagues set their own rules and violate FIFA statutes. That having been said, again, I'm very sympathetic with Ottawa fans and with the Ottawa club. But at some point, they're going to be playing in the Canadian League, and they need to get accustomed to that prospect. And I don't think it'll be as bad for their business as they think it will be. Although the one thing I will say is that USL has been good for them because they were on the precipice of, they were close to going out of business when they were in NASL. I know the amount of money they were losing. Obviously, I worked in that league. I was very aware of Ottawa's financial difficulties. They've recovered in USL. But I think long-term, it'd be better for them. It'd be better for Canadian soccer. And it'd probably be better for their bottom line if they played in the Canadian League. Again, it should not be this year. And CONCACAF has backed down. But 2020 or 2021, they should begin to prepare themselves to be in the Canadian Premier League.
And Robert, let me ask you this question, actually. Do you feel maybe CONCACAF is trying to fix their ways in some form to make themselves look more like a legitimate confederation than we've seen in the past between whether it's Jeffrey Webb or Jack Warner running this confederation in the past? To me, it sounds like they're trying to be more legitimate, like what UEFA and CONMEBOL has been trying to do. Well, we can't really say CONMEBOL now because of the whole Boca River situation with the Libertadores finals and stuff like that. But do you feel CONCACAF is trying to become more legitimate, and they're trying to set a precedent saying, look, we don't like what happened in our past, and what we are trying to do is make ourselves look more legitimate than what our predecessors have once did a long time ago?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting concept. I can't speak with as much inside information as Cardick does. He obviously has much better connections than I do. But, you know, I think it does sound like a situation where CONCACAF is forced to play nice and moderate between two of its three largest federations, and making sure that, you know, when we look ahead to 2026 and the World Cup and all the collaboration that the federations are going to have to do, that, you know, they can moderate disputes between, you know, USL and the Canadian Premier League, and to make sure the federations are on the same page. You know, it's interesting. I'm curious to see what the Canadian Premier League turns out to be. I was on the website the other day, and it's pretty slick. I mean, they doubled down on nationalism, and really talked about building the culture of the history of Canadian soccer. They embraced the history of Canadian soccer and what is Canadian soccer, and used that to kind of build the league's identity and the club's identity. So, you know, I'm curious to see what that league becomes, and, you know, what it takes away from market share from, you know, U.S. clubs and MLS and the lower divisions, USL and so on and so forth. So, I'm curious to see where it fits into the wider scheme of things, but I think from an initial launch point and just from their media outreach and their web presence, it's pretty impressive, and I think that it's pretty slick. So I have a sense that they're going to do some good things over the next few years to build this league.
Well,
Daniel, let me jump in there for just one second.
Go ahead.
I think Robert mentioned an important point. Victor Montagliani, I know him a little bit. Nationalism is a big part of this. He just feels like Canada has to have its own institutions, has to have its own identity in this sport, that their identity has been too closely linked to the United States, and that now he's the president of CONCACAF, so he can do something about it. So that's a big part of it. I'll concede that. He is a Canadian. He's a proud Canadian, and this is his baby in a way.
No, and I agree with that. Wait till the World Junior Ice Hockey Championships start after Thanksgiving. Then you'll really see some nationalism from Canada. But other than that, you know, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on my final show for this season. And, you know, we try to discuss these topics for our game in this country. Because why? Because, you know, look, if we're going to initiate some real discussion, we can't really hide behind whatever problems that are always going to be popping up. And that's why I always have you guys on. Because why? Because, you know, we can share our ideas, and at the same time, you know, we can have a legitimate discussion, because no one will. And it's always going to be, you know, a wishy-washy type of situation. We have to get out of our own way. If we don't get out of our own way, then we're going to fight and claw and scratch, and we'll be back to square one. And I think that's the one thing we cannot get to, that's the one place we cannot be at. We must go forward. And thank you guys for being on the show again. Happy, or should I say Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year, and I'll see you guys in 2019.
Thank you.
Thanks, same to you, Daniel.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, as always, thank you very much for listening to the 40 Scenes Fire American Soccer Show. Thank you for taking your time and giving me your time and your ears to listen to my voice. As once again, obviously there are many outlets out there to hear opinions about the game in this country, but as I try to give you the best content possible, the real heart and passion of American soccer is right here on the Four Year Scenes Fire American Soccer Show on blogtalkradio.com. Thanks again to my guests and Carter Kushner and Robert Hay. Thank you very much for listening to the show. And for the final time in the 2018 season, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody. Talk to you next time in the new year. And bye-bye for now.